So if you don't know where the things are, if you don't have an accurate asset inventory, and when I say asset, I mean like systems, data, infrastructure, et cetera. If you don't have that, you don't have good situational awareness. And if you don't have good situational awareness, you may not understand all of the things that you need to protect. More importantly, you may not understand if A gets compromised, that there's a three-node hop pathway to the thing you actually care about, which is Z.
This is the Detection at Scale podcast, a new show designed to help security practitioners succeed at managing and responding to threats at a modern cloud scale. As the volume of data increases and the attack surface expands, it's never been more important to stay ahead of the curve. Each episode will feature interviews with leading security practitioners, thought leaders, and company founders who are building the next generation of security tools. I'm your host, Jack Naglieri, founder and CEO of Panther Labs. Now, let's get into today's show.
Welcome back to another episode of Detection at Scale. Today, I'm here with my good friend, Jason Craig, who is the Director of Threat Detection and Incident Response at Remitly. Hello, Jason.
Hey, Jack. Good to be with you.
Good to see you. How are you doing?
Can't complain. Things are good.
We were just catching up about how oftentimes, because I live in the DC area, there's unknown helicopters kind of like flying around, and it's quite different from the Bay Area where everyone's just focused on like venture capital and tech. And here it's like, there's other things aside from that in the DC metro. So, and I happen to live or like be close to the CIA's headquarters. So it's always a fun little mix up. Jason, so we've known each other for a long time. We've worked together in the past. Can you just start by giving a little bit of a background on how you got into security, what you're working on right now? And then I have a bunch of questions I'm really curious about. And I know you have a wealth of knowledge into a lot of things like attacker groups and hackers and things like that. So I'm really excited to pick your brain there, but maybe just start by giving a quick background for folks.
Yeah, sure. Thanks. I appreciate it. So as you mentioned, I'm Director for Threat Detection and Incident Response at Remitly. We organize our security teams in terms of NIST CSF verticals, and I own a couple of those. So I own both Detect and Respond. We're focused on non-SOC, pro-engineer, pro-automation, pro-tooling sorts of approaches. Before my time at Remitly, I worked for a few companies that most of your listeners will probably have heard of in different roles, some in offensive security, some in detection response, some in threat intelligence, some in enterprise security. So I worked a lot of different roles in security organization in the last 20 years, which is crazy to say. But yeah, it's been about 20 years. So I've seen a lot of change, which has been both exciting and really, really hard to solve for. But yeah, before security, you know, when I was in high school, I worked for NASA, and I imagined that I would be a physicist. That was like my only thing. And so, you know, life is interesting. You have a lot of forks in the road and opportunities presented to you. And sometimes you say yes to taking one of those. And, you know, a hobby and being a hacker-minded kid led me down the right paths, not the wrong ones. And, you know, hobby turned into a career. It was very deliberate. I remember talking with my then girlfriend, now spouse, like 2003, 2004 about, you know, my potential career options in the future. And when she was in law school, and I was like, well, I think I'm going to forgo this stuff in the academic areas and just focus on this. I think there's a future here. Turns out there's a future here. So there's a fork in the road that I took that, and many other forks in that road that have led us to talk today, but it's just a series of opportunities that I chose to say yes to. And I think it's worked out really well for me intellectually. I think it's a much more interesting career area than probably my first option.
I love it. I love the life advice early in the show. And I totally agree that it's all about those forks in the road. And if you choose to say yes and see what happens, and I'm glad it led you down the path of security. And I agree, it was a good choice. It's a really important topic, and that's why we continue to talk about it. So what are you excited about right now in terms of what you're working on, just security in general? Like, what's top of mind for you?
I came to Remitly in August of last year. So I've been here over a year, and we've accomplished, I think, most of the things that we set out to accomplish this year. And so I'm focused on forward thinking, maturation, scaling the team, scaling capabilities, while not, you know, breaking the bank, and also trying to imagine creative solutions to a lot of problems we have. And so I think there's a universe of problems that we have, just like everybody else. There's a universe of problems we have that are specific to like fintech-ish. And then there's, I guess you call like research on the side that I'm actively engaged in, whether it's like trying to shape standards or trying to help other organizations with some of the similar challenges that we have or that I've enjoyed prior in prior points of my career, where we maybe struggled through a little bit, but they're done now and other people can maybe adopt them. and then just generally like collaboration in the InfoSec community, especially at a local level. The Bay Area is pretty, I live in the Bay Area and there's a lot of companies here that are security minded, a lot of tech companies, a lot of VCs. And I think networking is super important. You'll see me return to that probably in a few different answers I give, but just being active in the community in terms of seeing what's coming next and what people are innovating.
Yeah. And speaking of community, so I know you've given a lot of talks at B-Sides throughout the years. And one in particular I thought was really interesting is about Lapsus. And you had quite an interesting stance there about, you know, Lapsus is winning. And I was hoping you could educate the audience here about who Lapsus is, what their motives are, and how, as defenders, we should be thinking about just ransomware in general.
Yeah, I think Lapsus is like a very amorphous label. And I go through in that presentation, and I've given that presentation a couple other times now. I revert, like, because I'm lazy, to just referring it to as Lapsus, because there's like 15 other names people have. Different vendors, based on their own like naming convention and SEO, have different nomenclature. It's also a really, really hard grouping of people to like determine who's behind the scenes or who they might be collaborating with, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think Lapsus is kind of a de facto name from the earlier days before these groups have evolved into different things. And, you know, they all, I think, you know, if you refer to them as like the comm, that's like the most commonly universally accepted label, but that's not a brand, not a brand from a vendor, but they're hard to nail down and they've changed over time. Their tactics, techniques, and procedures have stayed very consistent. Like their TTPs are pretty consistent over time. And the tactics that they engage in, there have been escalations in some of their techniques and some of the severity of the techniques that they utilize. But they stay very consistent in a few different ways. And I think, like, I'll put it out there that, like, they've been, if not the most prolific, then one of the most prolific either threat groups or initial access brokers that have been around in the last 5 years that are now like a nation state. They're not shutting off the electricity in Ukraine, but the impact that they've had is really, really, really massive. And we all need to, like, people in the community tend to trivialize them and sort of wave off like, oh, they're not skilled or this or that. I think that's a really, really bad position to take. And I think it's dismissive. And I think we really should respect them quite a lot. In addition to respecting their success in offense, it was sort of like a no holds barred approach. They've been incredibly successful. And if your metric for like who's winning is, do you get breached? And like, do you have a massive event that costs you millions of dollars? And, or do you just like look bad? Like, does your stock price get adversely impacted because you had a breach, et cetera, et cetera? I think if you just look at the brass tacks of that calculus, they're clearly winning. And if we want to trivialize them, which again, I don't advocate for, I think it's a really bad tactic. Like, if you want to say, oh, they're just teenagers, which again, I think is wrong and they're worthy of respect. But if you take that approach, well, what does that make us? Teenagers are winning. So if you want to apply a teenager label to them, they're kicking our butts and they're doing it routinely. And there are defenses. There are ways to mitigate a lot of their TCPs and make it much, much harder for attackers to do that. And a lot of organizations just haven't had, for, you know, reasons I talk about in the presentations, there are a lot of reasons why they haven't adopted the practices that sort of solve this class of problem. But the solutions to this class of problem are out there. And if you, like, there's one huge public data point to point to, like, Google was very open with what happened to them in the 2010 timeframe with the Aurora stuff. Titan keys and security keys and Chromebooks, Chrome OS itself, those are all responses to Google's internal analysis of that incident. And their lessons learned, like, we have things like hardware security keys now. They were used to be U2F, now they're FIDO2 or WebAuthn. We have hardware platforms like Chrome OS, which are very, very malware resilient, and we just haven't adopted them enough to mitigate these styles of attack. So I think that I'll stand by my position, like, they're winning and we need to do better.
How can we start to think about doing better? So you said there's mitigations we can be taking, but just broadly, like, where do we even start? And can you talk also a little bit about the TTPs a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. The evolution of the comm is out of a lot of different communities, but partly out of the video game community. And the gaming community has a history of like adversary on adversary action to disrupt games or to disrupt servers. And they're really, really skillful at social engineering derivative of that. And they've gotten really adept at SIM swapping, which has been part of their TTPs over the years. SIM swapping is a technique whereby your phone number, through social engineering or technical account takeover, they're able to take your phone number and port it to their device without your knowledge or consent. And sometimes with like insider access credentials or insider bribery, et cetera. But they're able to port your phone number to their device And by virtue of that, they can get your two-factor authentication code SMS to them or your account recovery flow reset links sent to them before you realize it. They're able to take over your accounts. In the past, there have been like crypto whales as targets and similar types of high-value individuals. That's evolved over time to targeting organizations which may hold cryptocurrency or wallets. And now they're just, evolved to, they branch out, the groups have branched out, different groups are doing different things. And some now are, collaborating with ransomware actors. And we saw that, I think, the most notorious event, happened this summer related to, specific casino hotel chain. So those tactics are the social engineering components, the frameworks they deploy now to register phishing domains in addition to SIM porting, the register a phishing domain, they'll stand it up. It looks like a clone of your SSO, your corporate entity. And they'll start SMSing your employees. They have a database of people and positions, and they'll send you a very convincing text, sometimes with a voice message that's correlated to it saying, this is IT at XYZ company, and you need to log into this portal right now. Your account's being taken over, or please log in to this thing for whatever reason. They convince the employee to go to this, usually on a mobile device where most corporate security teams have very poor visibility at best. And they enter their account username and password. The attackers intercept that. They use a framework that passes in real time to the real website. And then when they get the response of 2FA method, either it's a push, which the employee will accept because they're expecting to log in at that time, or they enter OTP. And the one-time password gets also passed to the real service that the attacker now controls. And then the attacker is now in your SSO and has access to all the things derivative of that. And so their op tempo is very, very high. They're able to do this very rapidly before security teams can get good visibility into it, either through proactive reconnaissance or through employee reports of suspicious events like this. And so I think I described like at a high level, the majority of their tactics. Some of them have gotten a little crazier or more intense, depending on how you want to qualify it. There have been reports that they've like threatened people with physical violence and like saying like, hey, I know where your kids are at school right now. I know where you live. Here's a picture of your house. You have 10 minutes to give me your password, your call. They're all going to send somebody to your house or your kid's school. And I think that's been publicly documented. Like it's not some cheat code I'm using to like talk about that. That's been publicly documented and stuff like that. Now you have to design around. So if a threat actor is going to, they're really, again, they're really, really good at social engineering. They have a good database of people and where they work, and they'll do the work to figure out the right lever to apply to a victim to compel them if they're not voluntarily giving over their credentials through social engineering to compel them. And now as a security team, you never want to put your employees in jeopardy. So like you have a choice, like this is the world we live in. And these tactics have been successful in some cases. Can you deploy a process that mitigates that so that A, your employee is protected and not doesn't feel like they're under threat of physical violence from a threat actor, and B, like accommodates that such that the attacker understands that they're not able to get into the account, even if they do that. And I think some of these techniques that we haven't universally deployed at around 502 and WebAuthn, authentication, passwordless auth with a security key, probably a PIN or biometric to unlock that. And then an enforcement mechanism around, is this a corporate device? Is this like a managed healthy device? And there are other wins that come out of that for not just like, is it a managed healthy device? Like, there have been incidents where they've, many threat actors have bought credentials off of initial access brokers for like $8 to $10 for a Slack token. They import that into their computer and now they're in your Slack. There are mitigations and they're this like device health thing and then other mitigations on the authentication side. And I think there are technical challenges to deploying some of those things, but they're not impossible. A lot of organizations have done it. I think there's probably an education component for people understanding that this is deployable and not impossible. And we also need to work with vendors to ensure that we have better support of the stack across the board, because depending on like the famous example that like everybody talks about in these in close circles, that holds back like strong, like WebAuthn authentication. Like let's say, for example, you have a macOS device for your employees. Let's say for your additional data point, they run Microsoft Office Suite on their Mac and your authentication provider is say Okta. You can't do FIDO2 enforcement for Microsoft Office on macOS against Okta. You have to fall back to some of the 2FA mechanism because that stack is incompatible. And it's because of the way the browser gets packaged in the pop-up for Office and gets complicated. That's one application. Many modern organizations have 100 or more SaaS apps in an SSO. Now you have to figure that out across the entire matrix of those things. The authentication providers, the SSOs, aren't researching that themselves. They aren't tracking it. They're not working on it. Even when customers complain loudly about it, like, the stack owns part of that challenge as well. And while it's not impossible, it's just challenging.
So what you're saying is we can't do anything. No, I'm just kidding. But it does sound like it's incomplete.
It's incomplete. There's a lot of work to do in some cases. Like, some people have published guides on this, so that, like, there's a site called FIDO.fail where you can, like, go look at this and see, like, it's poorly maintained in terms of, like, community contribution. So the community should contribute to that. But, like, how many organizations use a specific stack, right? Like, if you're using the Workday application on iOS against Okta, that's another fail, right? That doesn't mean you can't do strong FIDO2 or WebAuthn authentication events, passwordless if you want to, with other apps. Because in most of these SSOs, you have, like, the SSO auth itself, which is the core service you auth to, and then each app. And many of them, your fallback should be, and can be, your worst MFA method for the specific ones that are requiring those worst MFA methods. Where FIDO2 or WebAuthn is supported for the stack, you can enforce that.
So, I mean, going back to what you're saying about SIM swapping, is there really anything you can do to prevent that?
It's very, very hard. I think, like, there's two different ways to look at it. There's, like, the paranoid security person hardcore way. Like, if you want to be extremely hardcore, like, you do something like use Google Fi with a Gmail-backed account on Google Fi that has advanced protection program enforcement, and then, like, good luck. You need to, like, black bag somebody's house and steal their FIDO keys to import their phone. Other than that, like, the less hardcore way is, like, you make sure you have a password on your cellular account so that people can't easily port it out. There's legislation being talked about now, regulation being talked about now. It's still, like, TBD. But I think the most important thing is just get your MFA methods off of cellular devices. Like, we shouldn't know, like, a person, it's fine if a person wants to have, like, an SMS 2FA method, and then they put that one-time password into, like, a login portal. Companies should not be doing that. Enterprises should not be doing that. Organizations that are higher security, higher trust organizations should not be doing that. And the way to just mitigate the whole class of phone problem is to give somebody a FIDO2 key, or use the built-in ones on devices that people already have.
Yeah, I made the switch over to YubiKeys a while ago, as I think a lot of us did in Silicon Valley, like, probably, I don't know, in the 2010s when that was becoming a thing.
Yeah, I remember my first corporate usage, and they've talked about this publicly, so it's not like a disclosure. Like, in 2013, we deployed YubiKeys at Facebook. That's a long time ago. And Google's done it for even longer, successfully. By the way, the thing I didn't mention earlier, since their migration to hardware security keys, they've been very public. They have had exactly zero account takeovers with a hardware-backed security key.
Wow.
So it's pretty strong. So I think, like, YubiKeys, like, I'm agnostic. I have friends that work at Yubico, so, like, full disclosure, but I'm sort of agnostic as to the brand or model, but hardware security key is by far the way to go, and it's FIDO2 or WebAuthn.
Yeah. And I think you said something important too around, it's fine for an individual to have a SMS-based 2FA. I mean, I would say we should probably still recommend that people don't do that, obviously. But I think the point you made around the enterprise, it's, like, totally unacceptable, I think makes a lot of sense, especially today when it's so commonplace for these phishing attacks to continue happening. Yeah. And honestly, now with, like, people taking public, like, blogs or podcasts or whatever and using AI to, like, create their own version of that, like, that makes it 10 times harder to differentiate between an attacker and the actual person.
For sure. Yeah. And I think, like, the other component of that is push, right? So it's in between sort of, like, the cellular OTP method and hardware security keys. A lot of people are like, oh, push is fine. Do internal testing. I guarantee if you send random pushes to your employees, you're going to have a non-zero success rate. It's going to be much higher than you want. And it doesn't matter, like, what time. Like, if you just start doing, like, I do this, like, you can abuse the Okta, I mean, use the Okta API to send employees verify pushes and just start measuring their accept rate and be like, nope, this is, and just be like, here's the data. Is this an acceptable ATO rate for a corporate account? If the answer is no, then you shouldn't do pushes, right? I did that with Duo and prior jobs I've worked where we used Duo. Like, it's never zero. And it's always much higher than you want.
So then the alternative is you auth through SSO, and then you present the key, and then,
that's right.
Yeah, I see. That makes a lot of sense. I feel like pushes were certainly more popular when Duo was really big, right? I mean, that's what they're famous for. And, you know, shout out to Duo, like incredible security company. They've gone to do incredible things. And I'm huge fans of them. And now like the shift to hardware has been good. And it seems like there's still work to be done here. The thing I was thinking about during your explanation of everything is ultimately, what are we trying to do, right? We're trying to protect identity and we're trying to protect information, right? So for someone who is dealing with detection, you know, going back to this idea of like building a good detection program or starting to talk about this idea of a good detection program, how should we think about operating in this world where it's imperfect in terms of our controls? And now we need to be thinking about how are we being proactive in finding the existence of these TTPs? And really, I think the biggest thing is where do we focus? Because there's so many things we could do. Like, how do you think about focus and importance?
So I think when you start with identity, like firstly, if you have hardware-backed MFA or hardware-backed authentication, that's like high trust, like security keys, you raise the noise floor for detection significantly. It's super, super, super elevated signal to noise ratio. So that eliminates a lot of background noise, which is really delightful. Because if you know that, for example, like I have a Titan key, like if I have a Titan key enrolled and I'm authenticating with that Titan key, you know that that's not phished. And no matter what anomalous thing happens with my authentication, independent of that, you know it's hardware backed MFA or authentication. And you know that is someone with my key or me. So it raises the noise floor significantly. And I think independent of that, behavioral profiling is like, there's a lot of different terms for it, but I think establishing a baseline of behavior for people, like people routinely refer to this as cohort analysis, is a really, really powerful technique. So cohort analysis is a good way to approach the authentication problem. Like say, for example, in one of these styles of attacks, whether it's like Lapsus or some ABT group, if you know I'm in an office in Seattle at the HQ and my authentication events are there for my SSO, let's say for my email provider, for my chat provider, for a cloud file storage provider. Everything is like from those source IPs. And that may be normal when I'm visiting the office because I don't sit in the office full time. So, but when I'm there, you know, it's me, especially if my laptop is there, which is another data point to correlate with. Or similarly, like if I'm at home, which most of the time I work from home office, if I'm at home, you know that IP too. And you can build a profile for me and my activity over time. If you know my current session is in San Francisco or in Seattle, and then suddenly I pop out of a VPS in France from like an OVH network, that's super sus. And that is not just an anomalous event, that was a highly suspicious event. And so if you know, based on user profiling of my activity over time, I've never done that before, then you want to alert off that. But again, if it's like a hardware-backed MFA event that also takes place from my laptop and you have the logs from my laptop to correlate those SSL authentication events or the SaaS authentication events against, then you have a very strong profile and high confidence that it's me doing regular legitimate things and not a threat actor either stealing my session cookies and reusing them somewhere else or via some suspicious OAuth grant or via actual account phishing. And so I think when you build techniques like that on the analytics side, it's very, very powerful. And I think like you can correlate against things like, is this a VPS provider? Is it a data center provider? Is it a commercial VPN exit node or a consumer VPN exit node? Is it some random AWS node? And if you use AWS, is it one of your nodes? Because that's something too, like sometimes attackers will hide if they know your organization is based in a cloud entity like AWS or GCP. Sometimes their infrastructure will be set up in those environments to look like you too, or at least to hide the noise if you're not doing sufficient cohort analysis. So I think those techniques are really, really powerful to go from like known good to anomalous to either dropping the event or surfacing it for an investigation or taking automated action to do like an account reset flow.
The interesting thing is SIEM responded to this however many years ago with the first introduction of user behavioral analytics, but I think in the security community in general, it's just not trusted. Why do you think that is? Like, what do you think we're struggling to nail with cohort analysis and behavioral profiling? Because it just doesn't seem like anyone's nailed it yet.
Like, I have my own sample bias and, you know, just being upfront about that. Like, I've never really enjoyed or utilized the past tooling, I guess the way I describe it, like prior tools that were like UBBA tools specifically by name, we've always built it ourselves. And the reason we've always built the analytics ourselves is because nobody does the things that we do. And so it's either not efficacious, like to your point, maybe it's just not doing the right analytic technique. But in addition to that, there are different techniques that I want to be able to utilize. So for example, like you brought up that chat for B-sides or that talk I gave the B-sides a long time ago. One of the things we talked about is like, if your CFO is running like a Z-shell process on her Mac and like the child process of that is like some Python PID, like that's probably not the CFO doing CFO things. And we knew that because we had data and we did that analysis.
Unless they're a hacker and they just, you know.
And then we're going to like, we're going to go figure that out, right? Or be like, hey, what are you doing? Like,
yeah, I'm just jamming on some Python script and trying to analyze these numbers.
I might prefer like Python to Excel than Excel some days.
Yeah. Shout out to CFOs. Excel. I
mean, hey, maybe they're running RR Jupiter. You never know.
That's right. No, it's really interesting. I mean, going back to behavioral analysis, do you think that there's a certain element where it needs to be very highly tailored to that organization? And that's probably why it hasn't really worked out. Because I just keep thinking about it all the time. Like, there's so many solutions on the shelf, but I think as practitioners, we've always ignored them for whatever reason. Yeah. So I just think it's an interesting mindset.
I think there's power there. Again, I'm just like, I don't know all of them and I'm kind of ignorant. I don't want to speak to things I don't know about generally, but I've seen ones that are effective. We built ones that are effective. And I think that, like, I want to believe, I think there's a challenge with investigative or like risk tolerance in these types of tools. Like, how many events do you want to surface for investigation? What kind of workload can you handle? How paranoid do you want to be about anomalies? Because anomalies are like the bread and butter of most DNR teams in terms of like, this is weird, I don't know if it's bad. And so if your risk tolerance is low, if you have a low acceptance of risk, then you're going to chase all those things down. And you're going to have more like human labor dedicated to investigating those anomalous things, or you have to build tooling to automate them faster or to automate them out. Like Slack bots, for example, are like a famous example of that, or like other analytic techniques doing analysis of other data sets that may be outside the primary data set you're alerting from. But yeah, I think that there's a lot of power there. And I don't know why it hasn't been as successful as people want it to be, but it may come back to risk tolerance and investigative workload and tuning.
That's true. I mean, the thing I think about all the time is how can we get better at baking in the organizational like logic effectively, right? Like,
yeah.
like what you're saying about the CFO, we have to get really smart about that. Can you just talk a little bit about how you think about building in that into your threat model and kind of like starting with the threat model, I guess?
Yeah, I think threat modeling is, you know, been talked about a lot. I think there's books published on it. There's playing cards even. Like, I think Microsoft put out like threat modeling playing cards at one point, in addition to the book. It's definitely an interesting body of knowledge. I think it's hard to apply in some cases, but it's a technique that I found incredibly impactful and effective. It's limited to your imagination in some ways, but having said that, I've still found it very impactful and effective. I think you have to start with the premise of, you know, what is the organization you're doing this work for do? Like, are you a social media company? Are you a cloud storage company? Are you a fintech? Like, what are the things that your business does and what things have value in your business? And what might the attacker want in your business? Now, in some cases, places I work, that's like user data. And sometimes it's a piece of the platform for criminal or other gains, espionage gains, or it's just money. And so I think it's important to understand the organization you work in and the context it operates in. Like, if you're a business, what does your business do? And what are the most important things you have? How do you prevent disruption of your business? And for example, if you're highly regulated, like a financial organization, you have a bunch of regulatory compliance regimes you have to operate in, or you have problems. So you have to safeguard the data you have. Like, for example, if you're going to give somebody your credit card, you need to safeguard that appropriately. If somebody has your bank account or your passport, like those things are all incredibly sensitive data points and need to be safeguarded differentially than other things. So for example, if you're safeguarding your favorite, you know, mechanical keyboard PIN board, that's probably different threat model than say, you know your customer passport data or like financial data. So I think identifying those things and building an understanding of where they are and the pathways to get to them and understanding the threat actors that might want to abuse those things for different reasons. Some will want to deny service to you, so they'll encrypt them and extort you. Some will just steal them, demand money, or they're going to dox you. And some others will steal it for their own financial gain that they use independently of extortion. So there's a lot of different avenues one can go down when doing threat modeling, but I think it's an exercise that's worth doing. It's hard to understand how to defend yourself appropriately without reasonable threat model.
Yeah. Got to know what you're protecting in order to protect it.
For sure.
And then when it comes to like the rubber meeting the road, so you go through the exercise, you say, it's most important for me to protect my customer's PII. Where do you start when it comes to logging and detection? Because that's a whole, we could spend another hour talking about each of those topics, but I think it's a thing that a lot of people struggle with just based on the sheer size sometimes. So what advice can you give folks on when it comes to logging and getting good eyes on your quote unquote crown jewels?
I think it's important to take a data risk-based approach in organizations that have sensitive data. So for example, if you're a company that's a financial services company, you probably care about safeguarding user data first and foremost. You have a hierarchy of needs like everywhere else, but let's say employee data, employee PIIs is sensitive, right? That's important to protect as well. But if you have to make a choice about which one you're going to invest in first, if you have a mountain of user data that's sensitive financial data, you should probably start there. Similarly, if it's like, you know, some other organization that has different types of data, they need to identify what those things are and take an approach to understanding, again, those pathways. And those pathways, there are always known knowns and unknown unknowns, you know? So I think it's always good to try to take input from others as to like what their concerns may be in the organization. But if you have an organization that relies on the cloud service like GCP or AWS or Azure or whatever, like there are ways to go understand and either infer or deduce those yourself in addition to relying on other people's input and documentation. But identifying where those data stores are and the ways to get them will lead you to a strategy of how to deploy a technique you can apply to getting observability data. And without observability data, you can't do detection. And without the understanding of the environment, you can't do response. So I think the cloud services have introduced a significant amount of complexity to us. At the same time, they can be very powerful. Like if you have a data center, a traditional metal data center, depending on the tools you have internally, it can be much more challenging to identify all of the things in that data center than it is in a single AWS account. So if you have a single AWS account with the right privileges, you can go discover all the things in that account and then start taking a strategy or deploy a strategy to get telemetry from the things you don't have and to ingest that somewhere and then to take analytics and apply them to that and not forget about other key things that gate into it. So things like your SSO provider. Most organizations that have things like AWS, SSO is somewhere. So the SSO is part of the equation now that you have to both log and do detections for as its key stepping stone to your AWS environment, which also holds, like, let's say, for example, a really sensitive RDS instance. And then taking a step back after you solve that, you now have to imagine the series of endpoints that are connecting to your Okta instance or your Azure AD or whatever, and getting telemetry and doing detections on those in addition to building response plans and runbooks.
Something you said that was really interesting was without understanding the environment, you can't do response. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So if you don't know where the things are, if you don't have an accurate asset inventory, and when I say asset, I mean like systems, data, infrastructure, et cetera. If you don't have that, you don't have good situational awareness. And if you don't have good situational awareness, you may not understand all of the things that you need to protect. More importantly, you may not understand if A gets compromised, that there's a three-node hop pathway to the thing you actually care about, which is Z. So you can go A to Z very quickly if you understand your environment. And oftentimes, you know, John Lambert has like a, you know, famous quote on, you know, attackers thinking graphs, defenders down. Attackers oftentimes have the most incentive and environment to understand it. And they oftentimes, in my experience, understand environments better than the defenders because they're the one with the biggest incentive. And they don't care about, you know, PRs. They don't care about change management. They just want to get their objectives accomplished as quickly as possible. And I think if you don't have an understanding of your environment, if node A gets compromised, you don't understand that your crown jewels may be in jeopardy very quickly if you don't take a containment action. And conversely, if you take a containment action on the wrong thing, you may disrupt your business accidentally.
It makes a lot of sense. That's actually the second time I've heard that quote in the last week. I think someone brought it up.
The Lambert one?
Yeah, the attackers thinking graphs. But yeah, it makes sense. I think that is becoming more common in detection these days, thinking about the sequence of behaviors and then using that to elevate up certain signals, you know, and I think there was a few open source projects that were designed to do this as well that were interesting. I think the challenge is balancing the complexity with defining logic like that, with like the usability of defenders being able to express the right combinations of things. But yeah, super interesting. I feel like you just gave a masterclass on threat modeling and detection and response. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
That's very kind. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Jason, we're towards the end of our time. So I was hoping, you know, you could leave us with even more advice, you know, because you haven't given us enough yet on the podcast, but maybe in usual style of the podcast, like what are three actual insights that you can give folks listening in, particularly leaders who are bootstrapping these functions for the first time and have to go figure these things out or might be new to it?
Yeah, thanks. It's hard to limit a set of recommendations to three, but I'll try. You know, I swear I'm not trolling you with Sun Tzu quotes, but like know thyself is the first one. That's super cliche, but it's also super hard to do in practice. And I think back to what I was reflecting earlier, if you don't have an accurate asset inventory, it's really hard to do prevention. It's really hard to do detection. It's really hard to do response. And I think having a strategy that embraces that and is constantly updated, hopefully through automation, like I'd recommend that very, very, very strongly. It is sort of key and critical, and you could say foundational, to doing multiple role types in security. So I think, you know, focusing on an understanding of your environment, especially as it relates to your business, is super crucial. Second thing, network, network, network. Like I can't emphasize strongly enough the value of personal and company networking. I've found it incredibly impactful in my career. I found it incredibly helpful. I try to participate actively myself, but also listen to others. And it is a significant time investment, but it's totally worth it. It is also enjoyable. Like I personally, maybe it's my academic background or something, but I enjoy ideation and collaboration and talking shop with people who are smarter than me in any area. And I try to surround myself actively with people that know more than I do about a lot of other topics. So I can both learn from them, but also hopefully contribute back one day. And I think that's both as a person, but more importantly, as an organization. And I think, you know, every organization should take an effort to network with their competitors because they're peers and they have common enemies. And it's probably not going to be a competitive advantage if one of them gets wrecked over the other. It's probably going to be bad for the whole ecosystem. And I can speak from direct experience. I have empirical data based on 10 years of doing this, like working weekly with direct competitors. I promise like your internal teams will say it's okay unless you present a really, really poor argument as to why you should do it. But yeah, I think getting blessed to do that internally is really, really powerful. And obviously, you know, what does it mean to be a citizen? That means like you participate. Don't be a barnacle. You know, when you engage in networking, like make it a point to also contribute. And the third thing, probably not surprising based on what we've already discussed, take the time and effort to codify adversary tracking in your organization. Like if you don't know who's attacking you, that's not good at long term. It's okay to start. But if you don't know who's attacking you and who your adversaries are, for whatever reason, you need to invest in that. And you need to codify that into like an operational component of some security team internally, whether it's, you know, labeled as quote unquote threat intelligence or whatever. I think it's really critical to do that because if you don't know who's attacking, people are already attacking you. The question is, do you know it or not? And who may be coming at you in the future is like the step up after understanding who's attacking you today. And I think, again, back to networking, work with your peers, work with working groups, ISACs, whatever. Get networked, get plugged into people that are in a similar vertical and actively work together to track adversaries and develop either compensating controls or try to do disruptions. Because eventually, if you're out in the cold by yourself, you're going to have a worse time.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Jason. It was incredible having the conversation and just hearing your perspective on all this. I learned a lot and I think folks listening will walk away learning a lot too. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Jack. I really appreciate it. It's good to be with you.
Always. All right. We'll see y'all next time. See ya.
Thank you for listening to the Detection at Scale podcast brought to you by Panther Labs. For access to the latest episodes, please visit our website at www.runpanther.io/podcast. And for those interested in running Panther, head to our website, runpanther.io, to sign up for a free trial. You'll get a dedicated instance with the ability to analyze your security logs in real time at any scale powered by Detections as Code and sending into a very robust security data lake. Our goal is to make detection and response easy, scalable, and fast for you, the practitioner. Thanks. See you again next time.